Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
James T. Kirk there for the original TV series Star Trek. This is Central Time. A lot has changed for a science fiction franchise that started in the 60s and is still spawning new programs today. And embracing change with all its risks is something that our next guest says has been key to Star Trek's lasting success. And he says it's one of the biggest life lessons Star Trek can teach us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Star Trek in any or all of its versions? All the series, a particular movie? Do you consider yourself a Trekkie? Do others? When did you first get into the show? Which show was it? Do you have a favorite character? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ryan Britt is the author of Luke Skywalker Can't Read and Other Geeky Truths and writes about Star Trek weekly for Den of Geek and Inverse. His latest book is called Phasers on Stun, How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. Ryan, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Now, this is a TV show that lasted 3 years or three seasons in its original run. A lot of shows have come and gone like that. What is it about the spirit, I guess, of Star Trek that made it last beyond that initial run?
Well, I think that the simple answer is that there had just never been anything like it before. There's kind of a pre-Star Trek pop culture world, and there's a post-Star Trek pop culture world. Before Star Trek, you didn't have a science fiction show for adults with continuing characters. And you certainly didn't have one that looked like that. People might snicker at some of the special effects but the production design of Star Trek was really something for its time. And, you know, you put that show up against, say, an episode of Doctor Who that aired in 1966, and I love Doctor Who. But you put up just the way that Star Trek is filmed and all the jump cuts and the close-ups and the music and the attention to detail and the costumes, and you can really see that it was ahead of its time in how big adventures could be done in science fiction for a mainstream audience. And I think that's the key, that it was really made to be a show that could be for everyone. That alone is why it endured, is because it invented itself. It invented a whole genre.
Now, you didn't choose to write a Star Trek book just for the heck of it. You've been a fan, I think, since you were in elementary school. What was your point of entry?
Yeah, my point of entry was, you know, I watched the original series with my mom and dad in reruns and on VHS. I was born in 81. So by the time The Next Generation was coming out in 87, I was six turning seven. And so I was already primed to know what Star Trek was. On top of that, you know, my earliest memory was being excited that LeVar Burton was in Star Trek, because as a child, I was, aware of LeVar Burton from reading Rainbow. You know, I can't imagine what the analogy would be like that for a child today. You know, like, what would that be? I'm not sure. You know, someone from Bluey is on Star Trek or something. You know what I mean? Like, and when I told LeVar Burton that, you know, last year, while I was interviewing him, he was like, well, yeah, I hear that a lot. You know, I'm the gateway drug to Star Trek for kids from the 80s and 90s. So that was my entry.
You got to talk to, in the course of researching this book and your past reporting, a lot of the central figures of Star Trek, including a conversation with William Shatner as your baby was waking up and crying and ready to be fed. And what is it like as a fan, but also as a reporter and author? Do you have that I'm not worthy moment as you come into a conversation like that?
Yeah, it depends. You know what I mean? Like there are actually two Shatner interviews in the book. You know, there's the one at the beginning from 2018, but then, you know, I got to interview him in 2021, right after his space flight. And mm-hmm. That was just kind of luck that happened and worked out. Yeah. You know, sometimes you have a moment where you're really nervous because you realize, even though, you know, as a professional, you interview people all the time, you must know how this goes too. You know, where you're like, sometimes it's sort of like, okay, it's work. I'm interviewing somebody, they're super famous, but you kind of are in the moment, you have to get through it. And then other times you're like, oh boy, I interviewed Patrick Stewart, you know, for Picard season 2. I don't think I got anything from the book in there, because I think the book was already out to press in March of this year. But, you know, I told Patrick Stewart on a Zoom call this year that I got into the works of Charles Dickens because of him, you know, and Patrick Stewart looks at me, you know, through the Zoom camera, seemingly into my soul, and is just like, that's very meaningful to me, Ryan, you know, and you're like, oh, my God, you know. So, you know, that was like a 5-minute interview. It was really short. But yeah, I mean, so there are moments where you go, holy wow, I can't believe this is happening. So yeah, but other times it is like, you know, you're in the moment of being a journalist or a writer, and you're kind of trying to get what you need, and try to, you know, be both, you know how it is, mm-hmm. present as a person, but also professional enough to, you know, not, you know, make the interview subject sure. feel like you're going to move in with them.
We're talking to Ryan Britt. His new book is called Phasers on Stun: How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Tim is with us in Avoca. Tim, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your story, Tim?
Basically, I'm 52. I started watching Star Trek. I was on after school when I got home off the school bus. And, man, it just, wow, it's captivating. And later, in, I just figured between, like, Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers, Star Trek, it made me a pretty well-rounded person about what was going on in my life, to the fact that my son's name is actually Tiberius. And he wasn't.
Oh, that's great.
After James Tiberius Kirk.
That's cool.
Awesome. Tim, thank you so much for sharing that experience. Ryan, a lot of people, I think, have that lifelong attachment to the show. And part of that, you write in the book that in ways the heroism, but also the errors and the things that go wrong with characters give us a sort of toolkit for dealing with life lessons in some ways from Star Trek. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, your caller, Tim, just said something funny about, he said Sesame Street, Mr. Yeah. Rogers, and Star Trek. And I think what's interesting about that is, you know, I think I make a joke at certain points in the book that the 60s show was kind of like after school specials written by like 60s stoners, you know, which is kind of true. You know, there was a, you know, Captain Kirk was often, you know, giving big speeches about the way people ought to be. And, you know, we won't kill today, he says in A Taste of Armageddon. That's what makes us, you know, that makes humanity what it is. So I think that there's the allegorical nature and the lessons drawn. But yeah, the Star Trek characters are for the most part adults. And so when adults make mistakes and then sort of figure out their mistakes, I think that that's really empowering to young people. You know, Picard says to Data in Peak Performance is that it is possible to commit no errors and still lose, you know, that's not weakness. That is life. And, you know, stuff like that, you know, makes a big impression on you. And then the flip side of that is, you know, Kirk and the Wrath of Khan saying, I don't believe the no-win scenario, but then sort of being proven through the events of that film that that's a bad attitude, you know, that facing a no-win scenario was important in a way for Captain Kirk was still growing and changing in his 50s and 60s. And I think that's something that not a lot of adventure narratives and heroes narratives do. You tend to say, okay, well, this person is, you know, they've won the day and now let's move on. But with Star Trek, the characters start as adults. And I think that's really, really interesting.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to author Ryan Britt about his new book, Phasers on Stun: How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has Star Trek changed your world? Do you have a lifelong conversation with Star Trek and its various series and movies over the years? Do you have a question for our guest about why things are the way they are in the Star Trek universe. He's spent a lot of time investigating that for the book. Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett. We continue our talk about all things Star Trek with author Ryan Britt. His new book is called Phasers on Stun, How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Kel is with us in Sugar Camp. Kel, hi.
Hi. I just want to say I was about 13 when the first series started, and our whole family would sit down and watch it every week. And what I wanted to say is that I want Gene Roddenberry's future. I think it's the only future that we can really aspire to. And I think that his image of this future that he was projecting is just wonderful.
Kel, thanks a lot for the call. Ryan, can you talk about that vision of the future from Gene Roddenberry and the other key players behind the scenes and on camera?
Yeah, I loved Sarah's heartfelt call. Or I'm sorry, what was the guest, the person that called him? Kel, I love Kel's heartfelt message there. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that what is interesting about all of that is not just like how we all sort of escape into that, right? We all sort of escape into that if we love Star Trek. But the interesting thing, I think, is how the shows have managed to say, okay, and then, but how do we keep it? You know, how do we keep it? How do we keep a good positive status quo as good as it can be? There was a great line in a new episode of Strange New Worlds where Dr. Mbenga says that, you know, all humanity became united, but then we got into space and we found new prejudices. And it indicated this idea that even when humanity got together, that then they discriminated against aliens and that there was still work to be done. So I think that within this sort of hopeful vision of the future, there's also this sense of, like, you know, vigilance, right? Like, you have to keep working on yourself. You have to keep making sure that, you know, you're being the best that you can be. And I think that that's something, you know, otherwise there wouldn't be any conflict in the stories, right? Like, Star Trek's not a show where people sit around and just are happy. You know, it's an action adventure show. And I think that, like, it's an action adventure show with a status quo of hope. And I think that's what Kel, that's what I love what she said so much, is that it's just like, yeah, like, this is the future and what they're doing is great. But then when there's problems, they're in a position to solve those problems in a way that, you know, characters in other action adventure narratives are not. It's more, the heroes are inherently a little bit more generous, I guess. And I think that's, when you're a young person, that's a big deal. The idea of these really generous, Mike McMahon, who's the showrunner of Lower Decks, Star Trek Lower Decks, said this great thing that's in the book about how the crew of the Next Generation was like these really responsible adults that felt like they were, like, you know, the best sort of, like, school counselors you could have. And I think there is something to that.
Kel, thanks for that call. Eric joins us now in Hazel Green. Eric, hi.
Hi. I've got two things I just want to say. I saw First Contact in the theater, and when it was revealed who made First Contact, I sat in the theater and I could, like, almost not breathe because it was so cool. You know, it connected so many things together for me. And the other comment I want to make is, I think whoever cast the Kelvin timeline did an incredibly great job.
Eric, thanks for the call. So the revelation about who humankind's first contact had been with historically, it kind of going back in Star Trek history there, how big a moment was that, Ryan?
Well, 96, so 96 was the 30th anniversary of Star Trek at the time. That was the year that First Contact was out. And let's see, I saw it in the theater too. Let's see how old I would have been. let's see, I was 10 in 91, so I was 15. So I remember that really well too. And I remember that moment being sort of shocking. And back then, you know, we didn't have internet and speculation and the trailers didn't give it away. So it was actually a really big moment. I remember a childhood friend of mine named Julie saw it with me, and we had gone to Star Trek conventions together. and just looking at each other like, yes, it's the Vulcans. And how and what's great about his comment is that that film is so hardcore. And like Jonathan Frakes in the book who directed that film said to me, you know, that that they tried to push Star Trek towards a horror genre with the Borg in First Contact. And yet, even that film that's super scary and dark and has all this horror imagery ends on this extremely upbeat note of the Vulcans showing up and making first contact with humanity. Yeah, I love it. It's one of my favorite films. I have the First Contact soundtrack on CD in my car right now. So I'm with him on that.
Thanks for that call, Eric. We're talking about all things Star Trek with Ryan Britt. His new book is called Phasers on Stun. Back to your calls now. Carrie is with us on the road. Carrie, hello.
Yes, I just have vivid memories of watching Star Trek, the original show, after school and finding it very inappropriate. as a small girl, and I would be clutching my candy necklace and going, "Ooh, he's like such a, you know, well, a lack of a better word, pig." And I just remember being very offended by that as a small child, and I've never really gotten into it. But now with the Big Bang Theory, watching that on repeats and seeing their a celebration of everything Star Wars, I think, and Star Trek, I think I can probably go back and revisit that as a you know, nearly 60-year-old woman now. I think I can do that now.
Great. Thanks for the call. Carrie, I think talking, Ryan, about Kirk's womanizing habits. Yeah.
She's got a point, though, you know, because I am, it's funny because with the original show, I realized, because I have a 5-year-old, that with the original show, I'm like, I got to be a little careful. I got to curate it pretty seriously, because a lot of it is to her point is not super appropriate. But what I would say is that maybe try the newest show, which is called Strange New Worlds, and see how you like it. Because I think that what the newest show has done, what Strange New Worlds has done, is said, here's the flavor of the original series. Here's the kind of like fun camaraderie, go team in space, but it's a contemporary show. You know what I mean? And so it's has a more of a contemporary sensibility. There's an episode that aired today about Spock and his, I won't say who it is, but someone who Spock's very close to, and trying to gain another perspective on somebody's point of view in a very science fiction way. And I think that the subsequent shows, actually, that's where The Next Generation, I think, really shined, is that The Next Generation was a much safer show for the family. And, you know, John Delancey, who played Q, I found a quote from him that I put in the book, that's, you know, that a child, a parent, and a grandparent could all watch The Next Generation. And from most of the episodes, that's true. And, you know, in the original series, yeah, you know, it was an action adventure show for adults. And so it had a lot of things in it that probably are not appropriate now. So I agree with her.
Thanks for that call. Mark is with us in Wauwatosa. Mark, hello.
Yeah, I had to suspend my disbelief about the first series. I was a teenager when I watched it, and Captain Kirk is calling all those shots like he's a submarine commander. Wouldn't the computers have been doing all that in the future? It always bothered me.
Mark, thanks for the call. That's not good, necessarily good drama if the computers do all the shots.
Yeah, and I think that the idea was that they wanted to, you know, if you watch the original series, Kirk is always really suspicious of any kind of automation, you know, like they're always finding a planet where there's like a computer that's taken over and it's masquerading as a god or something like that. You know, he does it a lot, where Kirk unmasks some god that is actually a computer running a culture. So Kirk had a hang up with computers running things, is all I'll say.
Thanks a lot, Mark, for that. Keith joins us now in Marshfield. Keith, hi.
Hi. I'm kind of curious. Why Enterprise? Being a World War II history buff, I've always been kind of curious as to why they called it the Enterprise.
Right, because there's aircraft carrier in real life.
Yeah, well, Roddenberry had a list of names, and Yorktown was the original idea for the ship. But he wanted it to be a ship that carried a name that had that would have been a World War II ship. Him being a World War II veteran himself, Gene Roddenberry. So I think that they settled on it from a list. And if you go back to the original pitch documents, it was Yorktown for a long time until it became Enterprise. Once they settled on it, there was no turning back.
Keith, thanks for the question. Mike joins us now in Green Lake. Mike, hello.
Hi, great show, great topic. I was a kid of the 60s. In the late 60s, I remember watching Star Trek as a very young boy with my brothers and sisters. And when I grew up, we continued to watch the show. And I liked it so much in the 80s and 90s that I put a lot on VHS tape. And when I got married in 2000 and I had kids, I showed them the VHS tape. So they got to see The Next Generation and Voyager. And my oldest daughter actually really liked Kate Mulgrew in that strong female lead. And now she's in college and she's a leader herself.
Fantastic, Mike. In our last minute or so, Ryan, I think people do look at Star Trek characters as role models in many ways.
Well, you know, Kate Mulgrew is a great example of that because, you know, Representative AOC cites Kate Mulgrew as one of her role models. Kate Mulgrew's Captain Janeway. So I think that that's 100% true. That's just one example, but Stacey Abrams was in the season finale of Star Trek Discovery, and she cites, you know, Picard and Data and a lot of folks from the shows as her sort of inspirations too.
Mike, thanks for the call. And Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Boldly go.
I will. Ryan Britt is an author and writer about all things Star Trek, plus some Star Wars, among other things. He talked to us today about his new book. It's called Phasers on Stun, How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. You can keep sharing your Star Trek stories at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, some states are looking to restrict social media companies from blocking users or content. The U.S. Supreme Court put a temporary hold on one of those laws in Texas. We'll find out what's at stake and what it all means for you. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the U.S. supply chain is seeing swings back and forth that continue to cause problems for workplaces and consumers. We'll sort out where the industry has made some progress, what issues could linger for the long term. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a children's clinical psychologist tells us how to have a helpful and productive conversation with our kids about school shootings following the most recent shooting in Uvalde, Texas. First, supply chain issues in the U.S. and around the world are improving in some ways, still struggling in others. From toilet paper to lumber and from simple products to complex microchips, one good after another has been hit by supply chain problems over the last couple of years. There are a lot of reasons behind that. Pandemic shutdowns, back and forth swings in demand, bottlenecks in the global shipping and transportation worlds. But our next guest says there's a fundamental problem. The global supply chain is built on a model that makes it super vulnerable to any kind of disruption. He says it all highlights a need for better supply chain regulation in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you still experiencing supply chain disruptions in your life, in your workplace? If you work in the shipping industry, what are you seeing? If you drive a truck, what is that like right now? If you run a business, have you been affected by the broken supply chain? Are you having trouble getting the stuff you need? If you are a builder this summer, what are things costing right now, those key materials? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. David Dan is the executive editor of The American Prospect. He's the author of books including Monopolized Life in the Age of Corporate Power and Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we start digging into the details, and there are lots of details, in some of the stuff you've written about this lately, you say we've just built this supply chain that is super vulnerable to disruptions. How is it working, or I guess not working?
Well, I mean, over the last 40 years, we have constructed a system of commerce that is built for efficiency over resiliency. And efficiency has come to mean cheap. It's kind of a euphemism for cheap. Make sure you can find the cheapest labor you can, make sure you can find a production facility that requires you to spend the least on environmental remediation, things like that. Make sure your shipping logistics is very cheap so that you can transport those goods. Make sure you're getting goods from the warehouse or from the facility, from the shipping port directly to the store, so you don't have a lot of inventory. It's known as just-in-time logistics. You only order as much as you need at that moment. That's cheaper. And so what that does is it introduces hidden risk into the system. And during the pandemic, we saw how this risk exploded.
What were some of the biggest things that threw a wrench into that just-in-time system?
Well, obviously, when you have production localized in one part of the world, in this case, China, any disruptions to that production system ends up magnifying. When you had increased demand for goods over services because everybody was sitting at home in the pandemic, not going to bars or restaurants, you had bottlenecks arise in the shipping infrastructure, in our port system. A lot of these mega ships can only be serviced by a handful of ports. About 40% of all imports come through the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach in the United States. And a recent global survey of port efficiency put LA and Long Beach dead last in 2021. And this is the port that we rely on the most for smooth transfer of goods from overseas into stores. There were other bottlenecks from trucking to rail for a variety of reasons, deregulation, investor preferences to reduce capacity, again, for cost reasons. This all created breakdowns in the system.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. James is with us in Green Bay. James, hi.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. So I'm a truck driver. I'm an hourly local truck driver. Most of the stuff that we consume moves on over-the-road trucks, guys who get paid by the mileage. I wouldn't go back to that. That stinks. We get pushed too hard. We work 14-hour days, which ain't so bad if you're working 3 days a week and get some home time. But nobody wants to do that 6 days a week anymore. The old guys who are okay doing it, they all retired early because of COVID. You can't get young people to do that. No one wants to work 60 hours a week, never see their family. No one at all wants to work 70 hours a week and then have to do your reset in some other state 500 miles from home. It's just hard to get new truckers. And because there's not new truckers, they're pushing us even harder to make up for the shortage, which is a short-term solution that's inevitably going to exacerbate the problem.
James, thanks a lot for the call. David.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that we don't have a shortage of truckers so much as we have a shortage of good trucking jobs. 450,000 people get their CDL licenses every year. The problem is there's massive turnover in this industry for a lot of the reasons that the caller described. It's just not as good a job as it was before deregulation in the late 1970s and in 1980 under the Carter administration. And, there's the problem is even worse with respect to port truckers who are often misclassified as independent contractors who, there are problems with, are they paid by the mile rather than the hour, as the caller mentioned. In port situations, because they're misclassified, they don't get a minimum wage, they don't get certain benefits and protections, they have to lease their own rigs, often from the company that dictates their employment. There are a whole host of problems with trucking, and a lot of it stems from the deregulation of the system back in 1980.
James, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth joins us now in Neenah. Elizabeth, hello.
Hi. I am originally from El Paso, Texas, and when I lived there, there was quite a bit of manufacturing accomplished. The initial materials were produced in the United States, but then sent to Mexico right across the border to be assembled and then brought back in. And I know that quite a bit of that has diminished as manufacturing shifted to Asia. But I'm wondering if maybe a lot of manufacturing, or at least assembly, might move back to our continent in order to minimize that. I mean, essentially, you can then rely on trucking rather than just shipping.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. David, is this happening?
It's a great point. I think because of the uncertainty created by supply shortages, by just not knowing when you order goods, whether they're going to be shipped on time, that we are starting to see, both in policymakers and among the business community, this desire to do more onshoring, to do more nearshoring, like bringing goods into Mexico rather than getting them in China for the production. And then there's been this concept talked about by Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and others about friendshoring. In other words, making sure production is in companies or countries with which we have a good relationship. Obviously, one of the biggest problems right now with respect to the supply chain is the reduction in energy supplies because so many of them came from Russia. And obviously, we banned oil imports from Russia after the Ukraine war, and energy prices have skyrocketed. And of course, energy prices factor into the cost of virtually every good that is transported in the United States. So that's another concept that's been talked about. I think there are definitely, certainly for critical goods, there is a strong case to be made. There's a bill right now in Congress. On the House side, it's called the Competes Act. On the Senate side, it's called the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act. That one version of it would give billions of dollars in supply chain resilience funding to reshore those kinds of critical goods, things like medical supplies, things like semiconductor chips, and the like.
Elizabeth, thanks for that call. We are talking about the supply chain, how to manage it, how to regulate it, with David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this affecting you in what you buy, in what you make and or sell at your workplace? What questions do you have about the supply chain problems, their impact on inflation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect, looking at supply chain problems still going on. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your ideas, your questions, your experiences. David, in some of your recent writing, you've looked at something you call the bullwhip effect, leading to absences of products and then gluts of said products. What is happening there?
Yeah, so essentially the point is this: when you're a retailer and you order a bunch of goods, you have to essentially guess at the expectation of whether there will be enough customers to buy those goods by the time they get there. Because once you order them, they have to be manufactured, they have to be shipped, and they have to be brought to your store. So there's been a high demand over the last several months, particularly for physical goods rather than services. But a combination of the Federal Reserve raising interest rates and trying to reduce demand, and also the shift back to services and away from goods, has created, at least in some products, less demand. The problem is that these retailers have already bought those goods and they're having them shipped. So you go from shortage to glut, and it's kind of like a bullwhip because there's time that it takes to cock that whip and have it, you know, repeat back. So that's what we're seeing in some places. Target has talked about this, and some other big box stores have talked about now suddenly they have a glut in certain items, and there might be clearance sales over the next couple months. So this is a common thing that happens in logistics because it just takes an amount of time to get goods shipped and delivered, and there's always the opportunity of demand falling off or rising.
Let's get back on the oceans now. Congress has actually been trying to tackle some kind of regulation of the transoceanic shipping industry as it comes into the United States. What is in the works? How might it help?
Well, it's sorely needed. I mean, you have an ocean shipping industry that in 2021 made as much money as they did in the previous 10 years combined. And in the first quarter of 2022, they announced $59.8 billion in profits. It's a highly concentrated industry. There are essentially three ocean alliances that do the bulk of ocean shipping throughout the world. They have raised prices significantly. They're also charging a number of fees that many cargo owners have said are unfair. And U.S. regulators do not have a lot of good authorities to actually make sure that there's fair dealing in this industry and that people aren't being price gouged. So there's a bill called the Ocean Shipping Reform Act. It passed with a whopping, I believe it was over 350 votes in the House by voice vote in the Senate. And so it's passed both houses pretty easily. That bill that I mentioned before, this competes U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, that ocean shipping bill got folded into it. And so if and when that passes, it's in a conference committee right now between the House and Senate. When that passes, the ocean shipping bill will probably be passed with it. And it gives a lot more authority to the Federal Maritime Commission and other regulators to, you know, crack down on unfair contracts, to look into these exorbitant fees, sometimes which are placed on cargo owners to get their cargo off ports, even though it's buried under 20 shipping containers and they can't get to it. It would be, I think, an important inflation-fighting tool to re-regulate this industry. It would kind of be one of the first re-regulations of an industry in America in decades.
Big picture, you're hoping for, I think, a lot more of that kind of action, right? More active steps by the U.S. government to keep the supply chain flowing more smoothly?
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of this will assist in the long term. But I think it's important that we not get caught short again, because pandemics aren't the only disruption that can really wreak havoc on a supply chain. We're seeing it right now with the war in Ukraine and what that's done to energy and also food prices. Ukraine is a big producer of wheat, for example. Anything can cause...
I think we lost you there, David. Are you still there? Well, I think we just have a minute or so left, so we'll wrap it up there. Thanks to our guest today, David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect magazine. He joined us today looking at how the shipping, manufacturing, and retail industries are responding to ongoing fluctuations in supply and demand. If you have more experiences to share, heard a great experience and a great question there, you can always email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Of Wisconsin's 600 historical markers, just 7 commemorate the history of the state's Black and African American residents. The Wisconsin Historical Society is working to change that now by adding about 40 markers recognizing the history of Black and other marginalized communities. As Diane Bazooka reports, one of the first new markers will highlight a southern Wisconsin lake town that was a safe haven for Black families from across the Midwest.
6 miles east of Lake Geneva is a small subdivision nestled beside a quiet lake, Lake Ivanhoe. Peter Baker first visited in the 1960s. He was 9 years old, and his friend brought him up from Chicago on a fishing trip.
I bet we caught over 70, 100 fish, bluegills and crappies, and it was the most exciting and life-changing thing for me. So we went home, and I ran in the house with all these fish, and I showed my mother. We were up there in Lake Ivanhoe, and it was all Black. And the first thing she said is to my father, Ernest, we're going up there next week.
The Bakers bought a house on Tuskegee Drive and moved the family up from Chicago. During the era of sundown towns where African Americans were not welcome after dark, he says Lake Ivanhoe was a refuge.
This was about as safe as life could get up here. We literally could sit in the middle of the roads at nighttime and watch the stars and talk and play. The freedom was unbelievable.
Baker later learned that was the whole idea when the community was dreamed up a century ago as the first Black-founded development in Wisconsin. In the wake of nationwide race riots, African American leaders from Chicago bought the land in the 1920s to build a Black resort town. It was an immediate hit, drawing families from across the region and performances at a central pavilion by acts like Cab Calloway. But the stock market crash in 1929 brought it all to an end. Following World War II, families like the Bakers rediscovered Lake Ivanhoe and slowly made it a year-round community. Baker eventually built his own home and raised his family here. Now he's president of the Lake Ivanhoe Homeowners Association.
This is our clubhouse right here. It was a much smaller place.
But he says things have changed. Now the community is mostly white and Hispanic. African Americans are only about 10% of the population. The lake needs dredging, the road needs repair, and the history of Lake Ivanhoe is fading. That's why Baker has been working on getting a historical marker. In recent years, he's been getting help from Katie Green.
Have you ever seen this?
Are these guys fishing on Lake Ivanhoe?
Yes, ice fishing. Look at this here.
Green has spent summers in Lake Geneva since the 70s, but she had never heard of Lake Ivanhoe until a few years ago when a friend's grandmother mentioned it.
I had asked all my friends that I grew up with in Lake Geneva, I asked all my current neighbors, have you heard of Ivanhoe? Nope, nope, nobody that I knew. So I started to dig into it.
That's how she met Baker. Now she and Baker often spend their Saturdays combing through old documents and newspapers.
Carol and Billy Cross? Do you?
They're trying to connect with past residents. One of the people they found was Janet Alexander Davis, who came to Lake Ivanhoe in the 50s on family fishing trips.
One time I caught what they call a dogfish. That was the ugliest fish I've ever seen. Ugly and big. But I was so proud of that fish.
She hasn't been back since childhood, but she's excited about the marker.
It's proof that we were treated differently in this society and continue to be, that we had to find our own way and have our own things because we couldn't just go where we wanted to go, to shop, to live, or to buy. So what I felt there was free.
Baker's planning a dedication ceremony for the new marker. He wants to invite past residents, have a pig roast and big band music, like the old days.
I plan on being here for a long time, hopefully for the rest of my life. And I just hope it's always a place that African Americans can feel safe in. I literally am at peace here.
And he believes recognizing the community is the best way to ensure future generations find refuge there, too. Diane Bazuka, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, have you had difficulty talking with your children or maybe your students, if you're a teacher, about the Uvalde, Texas shooting or school shootings in general? A clinical psychologist will help us begin those conversations and help work through emotions that your child may be experiencing as they deal with this news. We'll find out how to talk about these things at different age levels as well. If you have a question, maybe from your own family, maybe from your own classroom, you could share it right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. And we've got a couple open conversations going on over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Earlier this week, we asked you to share your favorite games, board games, card games, you name it. A bunch of you shared really great stories. You can keep sharing those, and we can put those on the air in future episodes. And a conversation about one of today's topics, the long history of Star Trek, the little show that kept going and going and going and is now creating new series to this day. We want to hear your Star Trek favorites, your memories, what got you into the show or what turned you away from it, a favorite era, a favorite character while you're at it. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.